So to start this evening, to get to know Dungshan a little better, let's hear another story of our author, Dungshan. This is actually case 94 in the Book of Serenity. Dungshan is unwell. He's sick. When Dungshan was unwell, a monk asked, "You're sick, teacher, but is there anyone who doesn't get sick?" And Dungshan said, "There is." And the monk said, "Does the one who's not sick look after you?" So the way we've been talking in this class, any ventures on it? Another name for the one who's not sick? Buddha nature. Or the jewel mirror. Jewel mirror never gets sick, but it reflects sickness just as it is. And it has no preference for health over sickness. It doesn't reject sickness, it doesn't grasp health, but it doesn't get sick itself. And actually, it's not even healthy. It doesn't fall into those dichotomies of health and sickness. So you're sick, ill, teacher, but is there anyone who does not get sick? There is. Does the one who's not sick look after you? I often like to think of the jewel mirror as holding us in its compassionate embrace, caring, looking after us when we're sick. So we might guess Dungshan would say, "Yes, that not sick one always looks after me," but he says, "Actually, I have the opportunity to look after him." So here, this is kind of like, even though Buddha nature is just holding us all the time, there's a practice. We can take up the practice of attending to the jewel mirror, attending to the not sick one. Us sick ones can attend to the not sick ones, even though the not sick one also attends to us.
Mm-hmm. Is there a different translation or any original that word you want him? I mean, it's so such a personification in the way I hear it.
I'm not sure what it is in the Chinese, but it seems like they're playing in this kind of poetic way with, "You are sick. Is there like someone, you know?" I think it just makes it a little more personal, maybe, than, "Is there something that doesn't get sick?" And like, you know, "Does that thing take care of you?" It's more like, it's a little bit personifying, but I think in just a kind of poetic way, because it's not a person, that one. But we might be able to translate it as, "It, there's something that is there something that looks after you? I have the opportunity to look after it." It could probably it could be translated that way, the way that these Chinese pronouns go. So yeah. So I have the opportunity to look after it, or him, or the non-sick one. And then the monk said, "How is it when you look after that non-sick one?" And Dungshan said, "At that time, I don't see any sickness. I don't see that that one has any sickness. Or I see that that one has no sickness." So that's the realization of the practice of looking after the not sick one. It's just seeing that he's not sick. Seeing that he's not sick. So I just thought this has a very similar feeling to this line we were talking about last week about the form and image behold each other. you know, I was looking into that again because we had some trouble with that. It could be translated. It's a different character than this story about attending, because I thought it would be nice if it that was. But you can translate the character facing a jewel mirror as attending to. So it's like attending to a jewel mirror, and in like attending to the not sick one. And at that time, form an image. So form, it's not the usual. There's several characters that are often used for form, like the form skanda and objects and so on. It's kind of an unusual character. I don't know why. Maybe for poetic reasons, Dongshan chose. But maybe, this may be a stretch, but maybe we could hear that the form we're talking about here is the mirror. So it's like attending. It's like attending to this precious mirror. The form of the mirror and the reflection, me, behold each other.
Yeah.
I think if we hear his form is like the object in front of the mirror, then we bring in this third category that just gets very confusing. But if we hear the form is the mirror, and the image, the reflection, beholding each other, then it's like the donkey looking at the well, and the well looking at the donkey. You know, when we attend to the not sick one, the not sick mirror, it's also, we see that actually I am not the not sick one. I'm the sick one. And to say, well, actually I am the not sick one, is a little too much like carrying myself forward to say that, you know. But the not sick one actually is me. So it's like attending to a dual mirror, that the form of the mirror and me, the reflection, behold each other. You, or I, am not it. It actually is me. So I think that all kind of works together. Yes.
This is helpful because I was having trouble with, in emptiness, any mirror existing. But if we take mirror as form that exists in the light and that in the white, in the light that is form or represents Buddha mind, but is the form of it reflecting, I can get that more, because in the darkness, in the emptiness, there would be no mirror in it, there would be nothing for it to reflect.
Yeah, I just think we have to, you know, not get too stuck on the metaphors, both of exactly how a mirror works, and also this light and dark metaphor. I think it's true, emptiness we associate with the darkness here, but when we're talking about Buddha nature, is not just emptiness. Buddha nature is luminous emptiness, or aware emptiness, or empty awareness. So in that way, we still have these images of black we still have to work with. So that's why I think I mentioned last week, Hakuin says at this first dropping off body and mind, there's just utter blackness, and this is the realization of this great perfect mirror wisdom. But at this time, the mirror amazingly is just black. So he tries to mix those two metaphors together, and he says there is a mirror that's going to shine in the next position. It's going to reflect when we get up from the cushion, for example. But this time there is a mirror, but it's not reflecting anything. Everything has been dropped off. So, you know, these are all metaphors, and I think if we stretch them too far, but I would still say that the mirror is it's an empty mirror. That's why it can reflect anything, because it doesn't have any fixed ideas. It's empty of all fixed ideas. It's empty of all reflections. Therefore, anything can be placed before it, and it's willing to reflect anything.
What does follow?
Mm-hmm.
If the mirror is really emptiness, and you see through the mirror. That's what I mean. You know, once it becomes solid enough, with the backing or whatever, or something that can actually reflect, becomes a thing for me, you know. So the metaphor is there, I accept it. But
yeah.
I struggle with that.
As a metaphor, we also have to see this kind of, the kind of mirror we're talking about, the precious mirror. It has no back, or it has no form. Yeah, no form. And that, but yet it's very, very. I think one of the nice things about the mirror metaphor is that no form is completely intimate with all forms, in the way that a mirror is completely intimate with the reflection. There's no separation, and yet the form doesn't kind of stick to the mirror. It's not like another nice point about the mirror as a metaphor for emptiness is that it keeps us from falling into a nihilistic version of emptiness, which is like just there's nothing at all, period. It's like that's maybe too far, because we know, as the Heart Sutra says, emptiness itself is form. And form is emptiness, so it's not an emptiness separate from form. So we've reached in this poem these lines of, it's like the six lines of the illumination hexagram, relative and what is our translation says, relative and ultimate, mm-hmm. interact, pile up, they make three, the complete transformation makes five. So, if we feel like we might be having some difficulty with this, how can we understand this kind of thing? It's so weird. Here's a story of not exactly an ancestor in our lineage, but Hakuin Zenji, the great 18th century reviver of Rinzai Zen in Japan, one of the greatest Japanese Zen teachers of all time. Very passionate about practice and realization. So this is an unusual story from, I think it's maybe not in book form, but it's a year-by-year biography of Hakuin, compiled by his student, Tore. So this is Hakuin's, he's 24 years old. And his main teacher was named Shoju. And there's many great anecdotes of Hakuin and Shoju practicing together. Shoju was so strict with Hakuin. Never let him get away with a half-hearted practice or understanding. And so he practiced with him for some time, and at one point Hakuin asked Shoju to instruct him in the Soto school's five positions of apparent and real. So this is it's Dongshan's teaching of the Soto school, but it was important to Hakuin's teacher and important to Hakuin. Maybe this is where it kind of like came back into the Rinzai school, could have been through Hakuin's teacher Shoju. But he asked him to explain this part. So Shoju said to Hakuin, "Well, tell me your own understanding of these five positions." And when Hakuin finished, Shoju said with a laugh, "Is that all? Nothing more?" And Hakuin was silent. And Shoju said, "There's nothing better for clarifying post-enlightenment training than Dongshan's five positions," said Shoju reprovingly. "Its principle is exceedingly profound. If there were no more to it than what you've understood, it would just be a useless piece of temple furniture." "Why do you suppose that Dongshan formulated the number of different positions that he did?" Shoju later transmitted the secrets of the five positions to Hakuin, but when he reached the passage, it's like the six lines of the illumination hexagram, apparent and real, interact, piled up, they make three. He stopped abruptly. And Hakuin begged him to continue and give him the secret of the passage that follows. The complete transformation makes five. Because he got up to the three, but not the five. And Shoju said, you can't expect to get it all in just one visit. Take a look at Dongshan's verses on the five positions, he said, which are these we have here on this handout. Those are Dongshan's verses. Don't read anything else. Pay no attention to the comments or theories others have made about them, which are numerous if you go into this study of the Dual Mirror Samadhi. If you do, you'll find yourself down inside the same old hole as those other pole cats. So the next year, Hakuin asked a favor of his Dharma brother, Sokaku, who is another student of Shoju. And he said, Shoju, our teacher, is advanced in years. It may not be possible for me to get to see him again. They were practicing in a different place. Brother Kaku, I'd like you to get him to teach you the secret of completely transform, they make five. The complete transformation makes five. Because you're about to go visit him. And I'm here, I have to teach a class in the temple here. So Kaku agreed, and they went their separate ways. And Sokaku came back from Shoju's hermitage during Hakuin's class meeting, just as he'd promised. And Hakuin asked him for the secret of the complete transformation passage of the five positions. Sokaku said, it's not easy. Sokaku, said Hakuin, would it make it easier if we enlisted the aid of some liquid prajna, which is this Japanese term for sake? Apparently a Zen term for sake. Some liquid prajna? And so Hakuin's fellow monks went out and tracked down a flask of sake. So Kaku's cup was filled, but as he raised it to his lips, Hakuin caught his hand. Have your drink after you give me the secret, he said. No, Sokaku said, let go of my hand. After you drink that sake, explained Hakuin, you won't be in any shape to explain it to me. Unable to come up with any reason to refuse, Sokaku finally began to explain the passage. He'd done no more than utter the words, the complete transformation makes five, when Hakuin suddenly realized the meaning. Stop, stop, I've got it now, I understand, he declared. The others around him were indignant. Don't stop him, they said. We don't understand it yet. Well, you can learn it from me, Hakuin said. So Kaku had by then finished off several cups of sake, and they all had a good laugh. Next day, when Hakuin found time to be alone with Sokaku, he set forth to him the understanding he had grasped. Not a word he spoke was inconsistent with the teaching that Shoju had entrusted to Sokaku.
Tell
us,
tell us.
They don't say. Just a biography. But you can read Hakuin's essay on the five positions, which is quite fun. And yeah, there's some little quotes there, and it's in the book Zen Dust as a translation. It's also in Thomas Cleary's book called Kensho. And this summer, when we do a class on the five positions, I think this would be the time to get into Hakuin's. But I just thought it was a colorful story about this great ancestor really struggling to understand this passage of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, going to great lengths.
Maybe we should introduce some liquid prajna in our study.
But first we have to really understand it. So So the six lines of the illumination hexagram, everyone seems to agree that it's this Li, the fifth rank, the fifth position there, that hexagram. The I Ching, by the way, means the Book of Changes. Ching is the same word used for sutra, so you could even call it the Change Sutra, or the Transformation Sutra, the Book of Transformations. And it's about all these combinations of these eight trigrams that you can multiply by the same eight to get 64 hexagrams, 64 combinations. And, you know, it's a divination manual, maybe the most ancient book in the world. Here's actually a photo of calligraphy by Hakuin with the illumination hexagram. So, and it says here something like jewel mirror, samadhi, the five, or the complete transformation of the relative and ultimate apparent and real. And I don't know what all the small prints is. So there's many versions because it's Dungshan just leaves it like that, right? So we don't know what Shouju's understanding was, but that looks like the most common understanding of how these lines are transformed is you start with the this double split hexagram, this number 30 in the fifth. That's the starting point. And I think I mentioned last week that you know, it's two trigrams, two duplicate trigrams piled on top of each other. You understand that, what mm-hmm. a trigram is? So it's like, also it's important to know that in the I Ching studies, solid lines are yang lines and split lines are yin. And in our, there's some variation here too, if you try to match up all these things about light and dark and so on. But yin is usually associated with black, and yang with white. So I think we can put, if you start matching these things up, the split line is a yin line. It's dark, it's black, it's the receptive. Yin means like the receptive, just like a mirror. It's not active. It's more like the source. The dark source, in this case, when we're matching these up, so like emptiness, the noumenal as opposed to the phenomenal, and so on. And yang is like the light that's expressed in the world, the active function as opposed to the essence, the form as opposed to emptiness, so on. Right. So there's this. These pairs that is in the Indian Buddhist teachings of form and emptiness, and in Chinese Buddhist teachings, the essence and the function are brought out, this pair. And then people like Dungshan and some others, these are the early days of Chan in China, they wanted to bring in their native Chinese system of the I Ching. And so, how nice that it's built around these same principles of these two kind of opposites and the changes, the integration around the opposites. So first, we could have the question, why choose that trigram to start this whole process from? And again, different stories. This is a book called The Inner Structure of the I Ching, Lama Govinda, who is a European practitioner who spent a lot of time in Tibet, became a lama. Actually, I just posted on the Zen Center Facebook page today a picture of Suzuki Roshi, Koben Chino Roshi, and Lama Govinda, and his wife, Li Gotami. You can look at the picture. He's got a long white beard and a Tibetan lama hat. They're all hanging out at Tassajara. And this is Compliments of Baker Roshi, Zen Center. So this is, Zen Center published this book, San Francisco Zen Center. So there's a foreword by Baker Roshi. These were the days when they were just supporting all kinds of creative projects. And Lama Govinda would come to Zen Center and teach. And I think they helped sponsor this book to happen. It's on, so there's all this, you know, complicated diagrams and about the structure of the I Ching. It's not actually the I Ching itself. But this is a classic thing. You may have seen these kind of things before in Chinatown. They're in the shops all around Chinatown. Yeah, probably. So it's the eight trigrams of the I Ching, with the yin and the yang in the middle. And system of Fu He, I think, is this. These are really, really ancient. This arrangement has all the yin lines on the bottom and all the yang lines on the top. And then the other six are around there. So the top and the bottom are like the central kind of positions in this diagram. So, and actually those are the first two hexagrams in the I Ching, the all yang and the all yin. But they're considered kind of like static, kind of like dead almost, hexagrams, because they're too one-sided. If it's all yang or all yin, there's no transformation possible. So it's this, I think this is a beautiful metaphor for this, you know, form and emptiness dialectic, is that you need these both sides to work together. You need yin and yang working together. So this later, King Wen, and also in ancient China, came up with this other arrangement where he puts the illumination trigram, the fire trigram on the top, and the opposite of it on the bottom. These two play out in these five positions. So, and if you, in the commentaries and so on, it talks about how the reason is because of this. It's like they're very dynamic. They're like the most, in a way, stable trigrams because they involve these two sides. More transformation is possible. So there was this shift in understanding that these are considered like the most important two trigrams of the eight. Are this one, the fire trigram, and the opposite of it with the yang line in the middle. So, and you could, so now we're in a way you could say one of those two would be the ideal ones to choose as like the culmination of Buddhist practice, right? Choose one of them, of the most important two, and of the two, we don't know. You know, these are all stories, but I think it's just very sweet that the one that was chosen is the one with the yin line in the center. That the receptive feminine core surrounded by the active masculine exterior, as opposed to the other way around. So, and also because it's the fire, it's the fire trigram. Also, it means in one classic I Ching translation, it's when you double these, the hexagram is called the clinging. But it supposedly means not like grasping, clinging, attachment, but more like intimacy type of like dependent co-arising. The way the fire clings to its fuel, the way a fire depends, so interdependence, the way a fire depends on its fuel is like that kind of clinging. But interestingly, it also means the opposite of clinging. If you look up in the standard dictionary, that character means like separating or letting go of. And it also is apparently connected with mind. You can, in this book there's some charts where it has all these different qualities of, and I think of the different trigrams connected with different, with the five elements and the five, you know, parts of the body, times of the day, all kinds of, you know, systematic correlations. I think just Chinese people got really into this kind of thing. So if you take that trigram and you double it to make a hexagram. The trigram is called fire, and then if it's the same one doubled, it has the same name as the trigram, so it's the fire or illumination hexagram. So one way to look at these transformations, since it's just one way, here's one version. You start with that one, and then this is something about I Ching studies, is that the top and the bottom lines are apparently like temporal lines, like they're beginning and end. And there's all kinds of representational stuff, but the top, the usually start with the bottom. The bottom and the top, the two edge lines of any hexagram are considered temporal lines, and the four inner lines are considered spatial or positional. They use the same character as the five positions, positional lines. So the temporal ones are like unstable, we could say. They're often, you can, to see the heart of the hexagram, you can drop away the top and the bottom. And then you see the inner heart of the hexagram is the four lines, and that's, four lines are made up of two trigrams. Right, so four is made up of, you take the bottom three lines of those four is one trigram, and you take the top three lines of those four and it's another trigram. And you might say, well, this sounds pretty arbitrary, but if you look in Wilhelm's I Ching is maybe the classic English version that was translated a long time ago and still is, I think, the kind of definitive translation. Big, thick, because it's got lots of commentaries. I was looking in there, and it says exactly that. It's like it's talking about how they saw the structure of these hexagrams and the top and the bottom are less important and drop away, and there's these two trigrams contained within the middle lines. Does that make sense, how you can get those two trigrams?
No.
Is there a kind of dynamism between the top and bottom lines and the inner core? Is there some kind of...
Probably, because they're considered the temporal and the spatial. Mm-hmm. So like space and time. So
there's the kind of...
Yeah, I think there's a relationship between them, yeah. I think that's what they see. Like the relationship between space and time. Mm-hmm. The time being, you could say. Is the time being, Uji is the relationship between space and time. Mm-hmm. So, same with that hexagram. It's like an Uji. All hexagrams are like Ujis. And you just take away the G, which is the time, top and bottom of the timelines, and you're left with the U, which is like just the being, the central being of that hexagram. Yes?
You're saying, so you read the four lines, you take three together and you have a new hexagram.
Yep.
You take the bottom through
another. Yeah, usually when you look at hexagrams, you look from the bottom up.
Okay.
First, you just, if you look at this illumination hexagram number 30 there, just take away the top and bottom solid lines.
Yeah.
And then you have four middle lines.
Right.
That's made up of two trigrams. So it's a yin, going from the bottom, a yin, yang, yang, right? Or a split, solid, solid. So that's one trigram. And now, if you take that and double it, there it is, the first position.
Mm.
Right?
Mm.
So some of these commentaries don't even make it a hexagram. They just leave it as, you just take the trigram, and they call the first position a trigram. This is nice because it makes them a hexagram, but it's basically just doubling it. Do you see how that worked? And then you take the next one, which is lines going up from the bottom lines, three, four, and five, solid, solid, split. That's the second rank, the second position. If you double it, yeah. So that would be one version of, you take It's like the six signs of the illumination hexagram. You go to the center of it, which is this kind of pretty standard thing that's done in the world of the I Ching, and you pull out the inner center of it. You pile them up, and it makes three. So that would be like, even though you're starting with number five, you kind of start with that, and then you pile up the two inner parts, and you get, so five, one, and two are piled up, they make three.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, all of this is related to it, right?
Yes, this is all about it.
So, this is all interesting. But now, it says, it is like all of this transformation of lines that you just said. How is that so?
Well, this is, I think, the very interesting thing. Like, what does all this have to do with it, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm curious. I mean, and I don't want to change. I'm just trying to get this.
Yeah.
So we've been talking about these various ways of thinking about it, and it's not fabricated, it's not fast speech, facing the drill mirror, and now how is, what's the itness of this?
Yeah.
Why is it like the six lines of the illumination hexagram?
Well, before we do that, let me just finish the story of the complete transformation makes five, because you don't want to wait for another time for that, right? So you can get it all at one time.
That's good.
One version of it.
Yeah.
So just, it may be obvious now. You may be able to figure out, actually, how they get, three and four. So basically, it's the same trigrams now. They're just piled up. You take the, if you're looking at the first two as two sets of trigrams, right? You take the bottom trigram of 57 and the trigram of 58, and you pile those up, and you get 28, right? And then you pile them up in the opposite order. You put one below the other, and you get 61. So, yeah? So once you see that, you can just see, it's pretty simple how these transform like that. So now, that's one story about what hexagrams these actually are, because Dongshan doesn't say, right? So we also then have these circles. Just to briefly mention the circles. So again, so it's the light and the dark. Remember, this is called the title of the position is the apparent within the real, which would be like, you know, the light within the dark, or the solid line within the split lines. So it's harder to see it with the lines from the title there, because there's a bunch of split and solid. But you can definitely see in the circle, right, the white. A little bit of white within the dark, and same with the real within the apparent. The real is the black, right? A little bit of black within the white. Remember now, white is like the relative truth, the reflections in the mirror. Black is like the empty mirror. And then coming from within the real is a little bit of ultimate. Surrounded by relative, and arriving in both, you know, there's a lot of speculation on why these circles are this way too, but you have a completely white, completely relative, and then you have the completely black. Some versions at the end, instead of the black, it's gray. It's a mix, a complete mix of the black and the white. So, what does this I Ching have to do with these? First you could say, what does these five positions have to do with it? It being the jewel mirror. It's like the jewel mirror is all about this relationship of ultimate truth and conventional truth. Or another way to put it, one apparently there's verses of Dongshan that aren't in his record, but it's in one of these commentaries where it's all about, instead of saying ultimate and relative, he says words and no words. So So he even titles them Words Within the No Words, No Words Within the Words, coming from within, no words arriving in words, unity of words and no words.
What is that?
It's not on these handouts, but it's
one of
these comparative things. It's apparently Dungshan did write those verses, though. They're attributed to Dungshan.
I'm noticing the absence of the Taoist black and white words.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's because if you put all these together, you might get something like that. But because we're like looking at these five aspects, it's more dynamic and complex than just the symmetry of that yin and yang. And maybe they felt like it was too Taoist to incorporate into a Buddhist teaching. I don't know. So we could also look at it as the relationship between the mirror and the reflections. And we're talking about in our experience here. And again, I don't want to get too far down the road of this five positions thing, because we have this whole class series, and it's, as you can imagine, we could spend a long time talking about the relationship of these five. But we could see it as, you know, relative and ultimate, or the real and the apparent, in terms of the dual mirror, are kind of like the not sick mirror and the sick one who is reflected in the mirror. And what's the relationship between those in our practice and experience? So very subtle, I think, the relationship and how to talk about. We might say, well, the relationship is just, there's only one relationship, isn't there? I mean, there's relative and ultimate, and, you know, ultimate's the true nature of the relative, and the relative's like the expression of the ultimate, period. And, you know, before Dungshan, it was kind of like that. It's just, there is definitely a relationship between form and emptiness and so on, but there's not five relationships. So this is kind of like this very dynamic thing of five different relationships or ways of looking at and experientially the relative and ultimate. Just to take one example without going too far into it, the first two are, I think, quite, you know, much easier to understand, I think, than the last three, personally. But, because they're more like, or as I wrote in here, form is emptiness. So it's like, one relationship is that maybe one way we could talk about it is like we're looking at a form, like a piece of paper, something like some object, and we see that it's actually not what we think it is. We see that it's empty of everything we think it is. So the form is actually empty. We really actually just see that it's not paper. We see that it's the absence of the paper in the paper. And then emptiness is form is kind of like, so anyway, the first one, form is emptiness, is kind of like Hakuin is talking about in complete deep samadhi, where your thinking has dropped away completely, and you're just totally present, but you don't actually even know where you are. What
like yeah. That?
The light and the dark. It's utter darkness, right? Nothing's happening. You don't even remember who you are for maybe a moment or two, right? Really deep samadhi, and then from that place, then there's expression. You can then you can get up and act. Or as Hakuin talks about, he talks at the bottom of these. Here, he says the first is like this, the great death. There's neither affliction nor enlightenment, no samsara or nirvana, totally empty and still, totally settled into deep, deep samadhi of the present, where there's no thinking at all. Maybe in sitchin sometimes can be where there's just nothing happening, right? And then the second position is more like now you're actually like functioning in the world. All things become your precious mirror, and you're their precious mirror, silver bowl filled with snow. Myriad things come forth and verify yourself, he quotes Dogen. Which is like, now there's a world of phenomena, a world of brightness, and but all of these things are like expressions of emptiness. Like emptiness is manifest in the world of form, rather than form is... when we look closely into form, we see that it's not form, it's empty. You know, those two are like two slightly different relationships, two different aspects of the same relationship. So that's briefly what these are about, these five different ways, five positions or modes of looking at this relationship of of the two truths, ultimate and conventional, apparent and real. And it seems to be right here at the heart of the dual mirror samadhi, because it does seem like, and we're actually getting into it naturally in our discussions, right, about like, well, the mirror seems like, if it's emptiness, why does it reflect? And it shouldn't have any back. I mean, these very discussions are we're already getting into these issues about, well, if it's an ultimate mirror, you should be able to see right through it. Why does it reflect? You could say, that's kind of getting into this relationship here. It's an empty mirror, and yet it reflects also.
Yes. Just a quick question. So just for clarification, these are forms and levels of understanding, or each?
Yeah, so...
you mentioned modes.
Yeah, modes. It's often, I think probably the most popular translation is five ranks, which I don't like to say it that way, because that implies that there's like they're progressive, or like better and worse hierarchy, So and you know, you can sometimes see them that way, and Dongshan has these other verses of that are more like a progression, and it looks like Hakuin is kind of implying there maybe is some progression here, but one way to see them is it's not actually a progression, but just five different modes or positions, ways of looking at this relationship.
Aspects.
Yeah, and permutations. And none are better than any others. They're all, of course, from the point of view of the mirror, they're all just... equally valuable, and in fact, they're all equally happening all the time too. They're just different ways of looking at. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just the explanation of what is actually happening, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you get to the very last one, where I've heard that described as the reality itself, and so this, when you're to use your paper.
Mm-hmm.
This is 100% paper and 100% not paper.
Uh-huh.
At the exact same time.
Mm-hmm.
That's reality itself. That's the reality of a piece of paper.
Mm.
So, or whatever else you want to pick up.
Well, yeah. it's never part, you know, like these circles could be misleading, and the things are almost ultimate, but a little relative. I think, like you say, it's always actually 100% each.
But
both at the same time, always. That is a way to look at the relationship, is both always,
right.
Ever, period. And from the point of view of experience, maybe we could say, in our experience, we're living in the light world, mostly. We hardly ever live in the darkness. So, even though it's none of this is really happening, we're not in accord with that so much. We're not appreciating that. Right?
Sure, we're usually not looking at it that way because we're in the world of dichotomies.
Yeah, we're doing stuff.
But we know that that's the reality itself. Mm-hmm.
Or you could say in terms of, you could experientially attending to the sick one more than the not sick one, or the not sick one more than the sick one. Maybe be one way to look at it too. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you turn on your flashlight. Mm-hmm. It's a very visceral way to experience this. It's the same forest, you're the same person, and the experience is very different.
Mm-hmm.
When you are looking, there's more, you know, directionality, and you just start, just like I did that one time, mm-hmm. and I just was looking at the path in front of my feet, because that's where my
yeah.
was.
Mm-hmm.
But when I turned off my flashlight, mm-hmm. I had to navigate myself by listening and feeling with my feet,
mm-hmm.
and a whole different sensibility mm-hmm. comes. Same person, same forest.
Yeah.
One
yeah.
is the aspect of the light, and the one is the aspect of the dark.
That's a nice story.
Yeah.
Because it's the same forest.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but a different experience
but
in the light of the dark.
But I don't know about 3, 4, and 5.
Yeah. So.
But you just explained 3, 4, and 5.
I did? Okay. Okay.
Sense and touch.
Sure. Because you're, you know, 5, or reality itself, is mm-hmm. like, okay, so it's the same forest.
Right.
Oh, but the exact same
yeah.
time.
Okay.
It's not, it's 100% whatever it is to your perception when the light is on, or when it's on, and it's still 100% whatever
yeah.
it is, whatever your perception is when you embrace the light. So.
Huh?
Stony?
Yes.
To me, and we were Christians, it's apropos of what we were just talking about before we came in, and I'm mm-hmm. circular about the mystery,
hmm.
mysticism and mystical Zen. You know, the black would, to me, be the mystery.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
And for me, it remains the mystery. You know, yes, it's the reality, but it's also the mystery we live in and hmm. press on in.
As soon as we discover something about it, then it becomes light.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So.
But the interesting other part of it that Kathy just brought up is there are times that I think all of us have experienced when we're in the dark forest and we don't have a flashlight, for some reason we're able to navigate. There's something.
Mm.
Something.
Intuition.
Knows.
Mm-hmm.
It really knows, because you don't bump into things. You can get right out of there and not even mm. touch a bush, you know,
mm-hmm.
in the complete dark. So that interests me too.
Yeah.
But that's not... Clearly, that's not by seeing and knowing,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
we can do it.
Yeah. I think it reminds me a little bit of Dongshan's first verse of, like, in the middle of the first night, before the moon shines, total darkness, no wonder when they meet, they don't recognize each other. Each is hidden, still embracing the aversion, or another translation is the beauty of former days. Like there's still, that's like this little, one way to hear this is like, there's some very, even in this deep, deep samadhi where we forget who we are, we don't know where we are or anything, there's still this underlying sense of like, there's somebody here, you might say, or there's still this memory of like a world. And we could say that maybe this intuitive navigating in the dark, there's some underlying bit of light that we can't see it, but that's what knows how to navigate through.
Yeah, and
maybe.
I mean, in just a slightly different way, I mean, that you can't know it, but you can sense it.
Yeah, and you can act from it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is perhaps a quibble, but the deep transformation suggests, at least in English, that leave cannot be the fifth. There must be a missing hexagram. If you have 5 variations on a theme, the theme is not one of the 5.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe that explanation was, we did say the complete transformation of that hexagram. Maybe we could say that, like, usually it would be that way. We could say in this case, the complete transformation includes itself.
Well, I consulted the interior this morning. The answer is 29 as we go to it's the opposite of 30.
And, oh, really? That's what you got?
Yeah, abysmal.
Abysmal. Like the abyss. The dark abyss.
Yeah.
Ah, interesting. Well, yeah, so this could be, again, all this is somewhat speculation, right? But this is one of the classic ways you could look at the complete transformation. And one, it is said that, this is a quote from Weilin Lai, who wrote this whole essay about trying to work this out. He says, when the yin-yang changes in this illumination hexagram are exhausted, that is, when the momentum of change implied in the hexagram is finally let to evolve to a state where there are no more transformations possible between yin and yang, there would have been a total of 5 patterns. These 5 patterns are then supposed to be the 5 positions at the heart of Dongshan's esoteric teaching. So, so that's another thing to look at is, and again, maybe there's something in I Ching studies about this, but it sounds like according to him, like all the possible combinations of yin and yang are played out, you know, starting from this hexagram, are played out. And I think, actually, I think, you know, when I look at it now, I think what he means is you only have those 6 lines to work with. Yeah? There's 2 yin lines in the hexagram. And are these all the combinations that have 2 yin lines? I didn't try calculating this. But you notice how they all have the same 6 lines. You take the trigram of 1 and the trigram of 2 and you pile those together. You stack those.
More than 2 trigrams of 5, then no. You
turn
them around. There are other combinations you could get with this 6.
Definitely there are combinations.
Oh, there are.
Or you could have the 2 yin lines at the bottom of 4.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
But then
you're right.
The
yeah,
trigram
yeah.
Of 5. Oh, yes, not using the 2 trigrams.
Right,
mm-hmm. Not using the 2 trigrams.
But maybe, maybe what's meant is that if you do this apparently somewhat traditional thing of like taking off the temporal lines at the top and the bottom, then if you just have those 2 new trigrams, then you only have these 4 possibilities. I think we could say that. And then you have the original that they're based on. So, it's true. I think all these things. So, we'll have to look into Bill's answer of 29 as a possible 5th transformation.
I don't think it's entirely there, but it's absent stuff.
Hmm. And it's...
The transformation is the opposite of all the lines and curves.
Is it symmetrical?
29? No. Just change all the lines from 30 and you get 29.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
So the yin and the yang opposites.
Yeah, except they were all moving lines.
So then you, but then you wouldn't have that, that 2 yin lines like all the other ones. Every other one has 2 yin lines. You, if people are interested in this too, you can make a copy of this book. I didn't bring it, but it's what's called Alfonso Verdú has this book called Dialectical Structure in Chinese Buddhist Thought or something like that, and it's got like. It's outrageous what he, the stuff he does, and he really, and he, there's all these, you know, Chinese commentaries on this, on these 5 positions, and he he puts it all together, makes up his own, has all these different diagrams, all this I Ching stuff all spread out, or, you know, it's like 100 pages, all on this, on these diagrams and I Ching hexagrams. So if you really want to get into it, you can go wild. He wasn't the first, right? He's in China, people went wild with this, all this symbolic stuff.
And
after Dongshan, there were phases where there's later in the Chinese canon, there's later commentators that played with this stuff, and Japanese teachers. And Dogen was apparently quite critical. You know, he says.
It's all right, but
it should sell it. Like in Dogen's Shobogenzo Shunju, which is spring and fall, in which he talks about Dongshan's hot and cold koan. Mm. It's, I think, the center of that, one of the main things in that fascicle. The Blue Cliff Record, when cold comes, the cold kills you, remember that one? In the Blue Cliff Record, the commentary quotes Dongshan's verses on the five positions and says, this koan's all about the five positions. Doesn't explain how, but Dogen says in Shunju, Spring and Fall, he says, if Buddha Dharma had been transmitted merely through the investigation of apparent and real, like this, how could it have reached this day? Peasants or stray cats who never understood the inner chamber of Dongshan and have not passed the threshold of the Buddha Dharma mistakenly say that Dongshan guided students with his theory of the five positions of apparent and real.
Peasants and cats?
Yeah, stray cats.
Stray cats.
This is an inadequate view. You shouldn't pay any attention to it. You should just investigate that the ancient ancestor has the treasury of the true Dharma eye. Do not mistakenly say that Dongshan's Buddha Dharma is the five positions of apparent and real. Later he says, you know, anyway, we'll save that for the summer. So, I think the way that it relates to the jewel mirror samadhi here, I think you can see the Charles Luke versions, I think is probably a traditional one, but I really like Taigen says this, you know, we talked about this before, right? Everywhere in the jewel mirrors, or five places in the jewel mirror samadhi, that character for true appears. Happens to be five places. Is it coincidence or not? But quite wonderfully, if you put, you can arrange, this is one traditional understanding here, these verses go quite nicely, especially again, the first, right? The true, the ultimate, the darkness, is bright just at midnight. It doesn't appear at dawn. So, it shines in the darkness. And when dawn comes, it doesn't, it no longer appears. It's just talking about this first position of the middle of the night, as Dongshan says, right? And then, you are not it. In truth, it is you. Right? We could say, the true is you. We could translate it. The ultimate is you is a little bit like the opposite of that, right? The first is saying, we're just talking about maybe you experiencing the ultimate. And now we're saying, no, you're not that. It's you is like the reflection back from the mirror. This is the mirror emphasis. And how nice that Dongshan, in his verses, talks about a mirror, right? An old woman encounters an ancient mirror. She clearly sees her face. So those two in particular, I think, match up quite well with the classic understanding of these first two positions. Now, the last three are more complex, but ultimately it does not apprehend anything because its speech is not yet true. And then the actual line that we're talking about is the goes with the fourth, the six lines of the illumination hexagram, apparent and true, interact. It's talking about the dynamic interaction. Dung Chan's verse is talking about two swords crossed. Like these two are like locked together, like in a sword fight, the two swords are kind of locked together and neither one can move. It's a little bit like this complete interaction. And in the end, subtly included within the true inquiry and response come up together. So within the true, the function emerges. Also, you see that Hakuin seems to imply a sort of progression. I don't think we have to see it as progression here, but he really emphasizes it gets more and more into bodhisattva vow as it goes along. The first are just these kind of like inner, our inner experience of how reality is working as a practitioner. And then as we get more and more comfortable with this dynamic of the relative and ultimate, now, as you see the third rank, bodhisattvas of the great vehicle do not dwell in the state they've realized. From the ocean of effortlessness, they radiate unconditional great compassion, riding on the four universal vows.
As it gets more integrated,
it becomes more compassionate. Yeah, and also less kind of like this intensive practice. Like the fourth one, they're going into the marketplace with gift-bestowing hands. And the fifth one is like, now they're just, you know, helping other foolish sages, hauling snow to fill a well.
That's what it comes down to.
Which is that image of that you can't fill a well with snow, right? It just keeps melting back into the water. So this endless vows to just keep practicing. And like, other people want to fill the well with snow? Okay, we'll help them. It's totally pointless and useless. It's never going anywhere, but we vow to just do it. We're no longer like, don't disturb my samadhi.
Right.
This is the progression,
is
you could say.
Is there a way of taking the second one, you know, the guest, and saying, you are not it, if the true is you, because that little black thing there. I mean, mostly white, but this
mm-hmm.
is
yep, the true is the little black coming in, yep.
Then going to the last one and saying, you are it, the true is you.
Which is the last circle?
The black. Just taking away that not. In other words, you are not it, it's true to you, and then you get over at the end. You are it, it is you, period. It was just the way Rob was saying it, or the way we were saying they're both together.
I think we could see it like that. Yeah, this is definitely not a definitive thing. I think we could see a line like that. It's so wonderful. You are not it, in truth, it is you. We don't want to, it would be a shame to limit that to just the second position, right?
Because I agree. I accept that.
Yeah. You know, I think I mentioned last time too, you could, I don't know how those were intended, but you could see it as almost like it's like a sun rising into the circle. So it's like the, you are not it, in truth, it is you, like it, the ultimate, is rising into you. It's coming to fill your light. Grip on things with darkness. And yeah, and the last two circles. Oh, so what are we doing here? Let's leave it at that for now. And
well, I do have to come back to get my answer, huh?
For these five positions, and you're welcome to read Dungshan's verses. You know, they seem really strange at first, but they're quite wonderful. I'll just mention the thing about you should avoid violating the present taboo name. Is just this Chinese thing of like the name of the emperor is I think this is maybe still true. The emperor is like almost like a god, right? This holy being, and you're not supposed to say that. The emperor has a name, but you're not supposed to say it. The people are not supposed to say it. It's too sacred to say. So that's the metaphor here. You know, the just don't don't say it. Don't talk about this dark, ultimate host. Any word you say, it violates the taboo of saying the emperor's name.
That's straight out of the Bible.
Hmm.
Can't say what it
means. Hmm. Of God, right? Of God. Like the taste of the fire-flavored herb, like a diamond thunderbolt. So apparently a fire-flavored herb is, Japanese we call shiso. You know shiso?
Yeah, shiso.
If you get sushi, oh, it's so great. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
And if you get umeboshi plums come with shiso leaves, pickled. Same with the sushi. When you get it, it's pickled. So, apparently, I don't know if in its raw form, it has these kind of five classical flavors of sweet, sour, salty, bitter, five-flavored herb. So somebody can try to look for some raw shiso leaves and bring them in. We can experiment.
It's a mint, right?
If we grew it, that would be interesting to try pickling. The pickled shiso is so great because I'm actually a fan of umeboshi plums. And, you know, they package them with like a little bit of shiso in with the plums, but much more plums than the shiso. And I'm always like, why don't they put more shiso in? You know, and like, I try to ration it out just like a tiny little bit. It's very strong. But anyway, the idea is that it's one herb with five flavors. So just like Rob saying, this is 100% apparent, 100% real. There's just one reality here, but it has five flavors, five positions. And a diamond thunderbolt. So our old translation actually made it clear by saying the five-pronged vajra. So, you know these. The vajra is... they have mostly in Tibetan Buddhism, but also in Japanese Shingon implement. Often goes with a bell, and for Vajrayana rituals, the Vajra is always held in the right hand, which is the yang, active hand, and it represents upaya, like skillful means, and the bell, which has a little vajra top. In the Dokusan room, we have a bell with one of these tops. It's the pear, and that's with prajna, wisdom, in the left yin hand. And they always go together, and sometimes they touch. So it's like the male and female, and there's these great mudras that circle the two together when you're doing mantras and Vajrayana sadhana practice. So these were a popular Buddhist thing from ancient times, and mostly Vajrayana, but Chinese and Japanese too. So, you know, and if you look at the end, it's like this one center with five, branches. And it's all, there's only one vajra, right? But it's, which means diamond thunderbolt vajra. Which are like, I always thought, that's just so weird, right? Diamond and thunderbolt are completely different images. But apparently the Sanskrit word vajra means, could be translated as both diamond, meaning like indestructible mineral, and thunderbolt, like a sudden, you know, energetic, crash. Usually diamond, like, sometimes they say Vajrayana is the diamond vehicle. Mm-hmm. To show you.
Not all the time.
But I so there's some ritual use that from Tibetan practices with the bell and the vajra that I sometimes use. They go together. So the idea, some people, you can see these diagrams in here where it's like, some people say it's the center and the sides and the, or that the center is actually split by a circle, right? So it's like the split line of the hexagram and the outsides are like the three. So I think that gets too weird. To me it seems like the center, and actually, there's lots of, anyway, there's these diagrams where it's like the third position is generally seen to be the center of the vajra. When you, these circles and the hexagrams you could arrange, this is seen to be like the center spoke, and the other, these two are like a pair of opposites, and these two are like a pair of opposites. But exactly, you know, these are things maybe Dzogchen talked about with his students, and hard to know exactly. But again, just like the five flavored herb, five aspects of one reality. And Vajra is kind of like a reality symbol. Like the taste of the five flavored herb, like a diamond thunderbolt. Subtly, yes. Vajra. Yeah, in the Chinese, from Japanese, Kongo. Thomas Cleary's that we chanted said that the taste of the five flavored herb, like the five pronged vajra. So, just like a diamond thunderbolt, you completely miss the five thing. It seems to be the point. Yeah, some notice it's something like the Chinese Zen people at this time were really into five, even before this. And one theory was it's like the what we call Nagarjuna's tetralemma. Tetralemma is like a four-parted lemma. Instead of a dilemma, is a two-aspect problem. And the tetralemma is the
Nagarjuna's
brain, but it's a classic Indian thing that it's all woven into the Zen thing too. But Nagarjuna is maybe the classic master of the tetralemma, which is like things, for example, they neither truly exist nor do they not exist at all, nor do they both exist and not exist. Nor do they neither exist nor not exist. Therefore, and that's four, right? So you could say, and then it's a little bit maybe like Bill's, ties into Bill's comment of like, you have these four, so what's with the fifth? And the fifth is like that which kind of like transcends all four, or that which is...
Let it go.
True, yeah, let it go. Just this person, you could say, is the fifth.
There is a
resolution of the tetralemma. Yeah. That's like, to make it something new. Chinese have to go beyond the Nagarjuna. So the fifth statement of reality is like just this person, or it's like a dual mirror.
Yeah.
Where that's us. The stray cats wander around the garden and enjoy the flowers.
Yeah.
You could go first. Yeah, and sometimes sniffing around for some five flavored herbs. Not finding any. We just have one flavored herbs here, which are actually really tasty. So, made it through that part. For now.
Yes.
Another comment on why eating hexagrams and circles is, it was just, you could see it as a creative expression to, like, there's this teaching beyond words or outside of words. And of course, the Zen people use words, but like Dungshan's expressing these things in a very different way than like Nagarjuna's Tetralemma, which is like highly analytical and very rational and philosophical type of language. Dungshan expresses this in these poems about old women and mirrors and swords crossed and all this imagery, and then these symbols of hexagrams and circles that are still expressions in the world of light, but they're not words. So the very fact that they're not words, our mind maybe relates to them in a little bit different way. You know, like working with the circle and the light coming in, like there's some feeling about that, slightly different than just saying, calling it the relative within the ultimate thing. Pictures. And, you know, symbols. Verbs. May all beings enjoy wandering around as stray cats through five-sided gardens, being just the people that they are. Beings are numberless, and we vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become.